compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hour three is here, and you are part of it, especially if you want to call in and be on the program with your comment or question. My number is 888-914-9149. Dr. Anthony Fauci, that's a name that we've heard endlessly for the better part of 2 years now, and he's in the news. Emily Zanotti's got an article in the Daily Wire. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and the chief medical advisor to President Joe Biden, is facing calls to answer for a shocking report published by The Intercept about the so-called gain-of-function research that the National Institute of Health funded at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. That's in China, obviously. The Wuhan Institute of Virology, WIV for short, is thought to be a possible origin point for COVID-19. In May of 2021, Dr. Fauci, in his testimony, by the way, I'm going to pause here. Cyrus, if you would please get me that audio of all of the CNN people and MSNBC and, you know, Nancy Pelosi and everybody else talking about the Chinese virus or the Wuhan virus. Let me know when you have that, please, because I'd like to just revisit that briefly. In May of 2021, Dr. Fauci, in his testimony to a Senate committee investigating whether the U.S. funded gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, Dr. Fauci claimed that the NIH has not ever and does not now fund gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. That seems pretty airtight, doesn't it? The Intercept, however, found through a Freedom of Information Act request evidence that the NIH issued a, quote, bat coronavirus grant to a group called the EcoHealth Alliance for $3.1 million. That's how big the grant was. And that included $599,000 that the Wuhan Institute of Virology, this is easy for me to say, that the Wuhan Institute of Virology used in part to identify and alter bat coronaviruses likely to infect humans. As the Daily Wire reported Tuesday, Dr. Richard Ebright, a molecular biologist at Rutgers, and an expert who spoke to The Intercept, elaborated on the findings on Twitter. And here's what he said. The materials show that the 2014 and 2019 NIH grants to EcoHealth with subcontracts to the Wuhan Institute of Virology funded gain-of-function research as defined in federal policies in effect in 2014 to 2017 and potential pandemic pathogen enhancement as defined in federal policies in effect in 2017 to the present. He noted that materials confirm the grant supported the construction in Wuhan of novel chimeric SARS-related coronaviruses that combined a spike gene from one coronavirus with genetic information from another coronavirus and confirmed the results, the resulting viruses could infect human cells. He also said, the materials reveal that the resulting novel laboratory-generated SARS-related coronaviruses also could infect mice engineered to display human receptors on cells, humanized mice, in other words. The materials further reveal, for the first time, that one of the resulting novel laboratory-generated SARS-related coronaviruses, one had not been previously disclosed publicly, was more pathogenic to humanized mice than the starting virus from which it was constructed, and thus not only was reasonably anticipated to exhibit enhanced pathogenicity, but indeed was demonstrated to exhibit enhanced pathogenicity. And I understand that term to mean that it is more virulent and more contagious. That puts Dr. Fauci in the spotlight. Dr. Ebright even suggested that Fauci was being untruthful in his remarks to the Senate. Several Republicans have already suggested that Dr. Fauci must face a full investigation and be totally forthcoming about his agency's and the NIH's involvement in funding research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Representative Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio, suggested that Dr. Fauci is hiding something and should face an investigation. And former White House physician turned Congressman Representative Ronnie Jackson, Republican of Texas, also demanded answers and for Dr. Fauci to be terminated from his role as a top health advisor to the president. Now, I have some audio here from Representative Ronny Jackson to that effect. Let's listen.
What I do know is that Dr. Fauci has been so wrong so many times, and he's appeared so dishonest in some of the stuff he's said and done since this outbreak started, that I can't believe that he's even in a position of authority right now and that we're even listening to him anymore. We should be investigating Dr. Fauci, not taking advice from Dr. Fauci. This Washington Post article that recently came out is just unbelievable, some of the stuff that was going on at NIH that Dr. Fauci was intimately involved in. We need to get to the bottom of what happened, and I think that we will ultimately find out that Dr. Fauci had a very big role in this particular pandemic, and a lot of it's going to be traced right back to him and the money he provided to the Wuhan lab.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, we have, just to not put too fine a point on it, but as you know now, it is verboten to refer to even the possibility that this virus was engineered in China. Now, I remember in late 2019, you do too. I mean, just remember all the stories that were coming out about this virus that was just destroying the people that came in contact with it in China. Remember how they built something like a 2,000-bed hospital overnight because they can? And how people were really suffering and there were lockdowns. And, you know, back in the late part of 2019, when this was happening in the city of Wuhan in China, everybody recognized, okay, there's something going on there, but it didn't really seep into the popular mindset as to how quickly that would come here and go to the rest of the world. So we have just a little montage, and I forget who put this together, Cyrus. Was this the Daily Caller or one of those? I forget who put this together.
I do not have the info. This is from quite a while ago now, but it's fun to revisit.
Yeah, it's fun to revisit. And here's why, because there's a double standard. There's a kind of hypocrisy. And people say, well, you know, calling it the Wuhan virus or the Chinese virus, you're a racist if you do that. Well, here is just a montage of politicians, so we're talking about leftist politicians, and of course CNN and MSNBC, a whole cast of characters, and this is what they were saying not that long ago.
Blame. Concern is growing this morning over an outbreak of a new SARS-like virus in China. At least six people have died from the Wuhan coronavirus.
The Wuhan coronavirus. The Wuhan coronavirus.
The 34-year-old ophthalmologist diagnosed Saturday with the Wuhan coronavirus.
The Wuhan virus.
The Wuhan coronavirus.
The Wuhan coronavirus. What more can you tell us about the similarities or differences between SARS and the Wuhan coronavirus?
The Wuhan coronavirus.
The Wuhan coronavirus in China.
The Wuhan coronavirus.
The Wuhan coronavirus.
Right. I think you get the idea. It continues. It continues in that vein for another minute or two. And it's just one after the other after the other. I think it's just another example of the hypocrisy. Anyway, so we have a link to that article if you're interested in reading it. You'll find it on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show, or you can go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you can find it there. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Let's go now to Kathy in Milwaukee. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call and sure. for sharing your wonderful ministry with us.
Thank you.
I have a question. What evidence does the Catholic Church have that Mary and Joseph never consummated their marital relationship?
Well, there are two bodies of evidence. One would be the scriptural evidence that is implicit. In other words, the Holy Bible doesn't say that Mary didn't have other children besides Jesus in an explicit sense. And the Holy Bible also doesn't say in any explicit sense that Mary did have other children. So we're left to glean the implicit evidence, and there's a mountain of implicit evidence on that topic. So that first body of evidence would be biblical, and I can share a few of those details with you if you want. The second body of evidence would be the church's apostolic tradition. As it says, St. Paul himself says this in 2 Thessalonians 2:15. He says, to stand firm and hold fast to the traditions you receive from us, either by an oral statement or by a letter of ours. So there he's saying, don't go by the Bible alone, but hold fast also, in addition to the Bible, to the oral tradition of the church. Now, the consistent, unbroken oral tradition of the church, we call it apostolic tradition, that has consistently conveyed to us from the earliest days where it's mentioned that Mary remained a virgin. So that would go from the eyewitnesses to Jesus and his ministry all the way forward to the present day. So we have that to rely upon as well. And the key there, Kathy, is that that helps us, that provides us with, you might say, an interpretive key for Scripture. So when we approach a passage in Scripture, for example, in Matthew chapter 1, where it says about St. Joseph that he knew her not until she brought forth her firstborn son, namely Jesus, we can read that in 21st century American English and draw conclusions that may or may not be true. It may or may not be the case that there were normal marital relations after Jesus was born. The statement itself is simply saying that prior to the birth of Jesus, there was there was no sexual activity involved, that this was in fact a miraculous virgin birth. So when we approach a topic like that, the apostolic tradition is indispensable because it helps us keep our balance and say, are we understanding this passage in the way that it was understood, say, in the first, second, third, fourth century? And do we see a continuous testimony to a certain way of understanding a passage like this? Or do we see lots of different opinions and nobody was really clear about it? Well, certainly in this case, with regard to Mary's perpetual virginity, there is a unanimity and a universality in apostolic tradition that Mary remained a virgin her whole life. Now, one of the interesting details here, which you will see in Luke's Gospel, chapter 1, I think I may have read this on the air the other day, but just to revisit it, Kathy. When the angel Gabriel first appears to Zechariah, who's the father of St. John the Baptist, and he fathered St. John the Baptist the way fathers father children, so there was nothing miraculous about that, except for the fact that he was a very old man and his wife was a very old woman, well past childbearing age. But when you read this passage, read Luke chapter 1, you'll see that when the angel came to him and told him, your wife is going to have a baby, he said, and not unreasonably, he said, well, how can this be? You know, she's very old. And one can presume, I think by reading between the lines, that he may also have meant, you know, and we're not doing anything that would cause a baby to be born because we're old people now. That seems to be implicit in his statement as well. So he expresses his puzzlement, like how can this be because of the circumstances? And what happens? He gets punished. He's struck mute and he doesn't recover his speech until the time of St. John the Baptist after he's born and he's going to be circumcised and he can receive his name. That's where this punishment is ended. Then the very next episode you see in Luke's gospel is that the same angel goes now to Mary and gives her, in essence, the same message. Whereas in the case of Zechariah, he's told that his wife's going to have a baby. But in the case of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the angel says, you're going to have a baby. So one of these implicit evidences is very strongly found here, and that is Mary's reaction. She says essentially the same thing that Zechariah says. She says, well, how can this be? Because I do not know man. Now, she was already betrothed to her husband, and in those days and in that culture and religion, the betrothal was the first phase of the marriage. The second phase would be where the couple began to cohabitate and live as married people live and consummate the marriage, etc. So her reaction is the same as Zechariah's, but not only is she not punished, it's explained to her, look, it's not going to be like what you think. The Holy Spirit's going to overshadow you. And the child born to you will be the Holy One. So the angel reassures her. Now, her reaction under those circumstances only makes sense. Now, this is implicit. Again, it's not an explicit statement. But it only makes sense if, as the church fathers posited, she had taken a vow of perpetual virginity at some point before that. Now, that was not common, but it certainly wasn't unknown. St. John the Baptist was a Nazarite, and one of the vows that the Nazarites took was to not get married and to be celibate for the rest of their lives. Now, in this case, a woman couldn't do that because women couldn't live on their own in that culture. So Mary would be in the care of her husband, but she also by the evidence here, must have taken this vow of perpetual virginity, because then her reaction makes sense. Like, wait a minute, God knows that I've made this vow not to consummate the marriage with my husband. So he's sending an angel to tell me I'm going to have a baby. How is this going to happen? I don't understand it. Now, if she hadn't taken the vow of virginity, then what do we make of her reaction? Why would she say that? I mean, certainly she knew how babies come into this world. She knew that her girlfriends and family members who got married soon enough began to have babies. She understood how that all that worked. And so her reaction to the angel doesn't make any sense at all. If she intended to have normal, or let's just say typical, marital relations with her husband. Now, there are countless other examples. I'll leave it at that. Maybe I'll throw in one or two more. You'll notice at the foot of the cross in John 19, where St. John is standing at the foot of the cross with Mary, and Jesus entrusts his mother into the care of St. John. And we're told from that day forward, she lived with St. John and he took care of her. You know, mother or son, behold your mother, woman, behold your son. Now, that too would seem extremely odd if Jesus had siblings. If he actually had, or if Mary actually had other sons, that would have been entirely unusual, to say the least, that the Lord would entrust her into the care of a non-family member, and yet he did. We also see at the finding in the temple when Jesus was 12 years of age, we see no mention of any other siblings. There's just Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. And lastly, in one of the few passages that does refer to the brothers of the Lord, we see four of them named. And so this is in Matthew chapter 13. And the names given are James, Joseph, Simon, and Jude. And we know with certitude that two of the four who are called the brothers of the Lord, they are the sons of a different Mary, the sons of Mary, the wife of Cleophas. She too is at the foot of the cross, by the way. We see her in John chapter 19. So at each step, all of the evidence points in the direction of Mary being a perpetual virgin. And then when you stack up against that, the church's continuous and unanimous and universal recognition of Mary's perpetual virginity, I think it really cinches the case. I'll have to leave it at that, Kathy. I realize you may have a follow-up question or two, but does that help a little bit?
It does. Thank you so much.
You are most welcome. And if you're interested in reading more on that topic, do I have an article on that? I'm not sure if I have an article on that topic in my series of articles that are available at my website, but you can check there. Just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick and you can click on the links for the articles. It'll take you there. But I do have chapters on this topic in a few of my books if you're interested. Thank you. Let's go now to, let's go to Barbara in Minneapolis. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, Patrick. What a pleasure it is to chat with you this morning.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question, and forgive me if you've already talked about this subject. I'm a night shifter, so I just listen to you when I'm on my way home. With all the challenges of COVID and experiencing the mass by way of the television and those types of live feeds, when the church wasn't open, I wonder, is it just as authentic to adore the Blessed Sacrament by way of a live feed? Because I have found that also available on YouTube, and I just certainly best to actually go to church. But with my night shifts and such, I find with my fatigue, is that an opportunity to?
Yes, I would look at it. Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. The answer is yes, but it's different. So when you're in the immediate presence of our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament, you know, you are adoring him in his presence. Now, in the case of being at home, for example, and following Eucharistic adoration or Mass for that matter, I think the way to think of it is it's like looking at a picture. It's like looking at a crucifix. So when you see a crucifix, you're not in the direct presence of Jesus as the apostles were during his public ministry. You're in his presence in a general sense, but not in the way that they were physically present to him all those years ago. But yet you can still adore the Lord. You can still pray to him, talk to him as if he were right there with you, because the crucifix is a symbol of him. And in the same way, what you see on television, those pixels on the screen, those are a symbol of the reality of the mass that's being celebrated 500 miles away or what have you. So if you see it that way, you can say, well, this is in keeping with all those other symbols or ways of expressing the presence of the Lord, and you can adore him. But remember this, you're not adoring the screen. You're not adoring the pixels on the screen. Those are just artifacts of electronics and radio waves, etc. Those represent the real Blessed Sacrament in that place. So even though you may be 500 miles away, by seeing it on TV, it's like looking at a picture of Mary or Jesus, and you're now ordering your mind toward the reality. And in that case, yes, you can adore, but just remember, you're not adoring what you see on the screen. You're adoring what the screen represents, if you see Absolutely. The distinction. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome. You're most welcome. And I hope that.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you. I hope that circumstances turn out where you don't have to work as hard or be as fatigued as you are right now, Barbara. But God bless you for being such a faithful Catholic. I will be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
You may remember the young man who called, I don't know, 20 minutes or so ago, asking about how he was at Mass and a seminarian gave the sermon. And he wanted to know, is that correct? And I said, no, it's not correct. But I hesitated only because I wanted to double check first to make sure that I understood exactly what canon law said on this issue. But my instinct was confirmed by Deacon Richard on Twitter, who was kind enough to send me the text of the canon law that discusses this. So this is an article called Frequently Asked Questions Regarding Who Can Preach a Homily During the Holy Mass. Question, what are the Catholic Church's instructions regarding who can preach a homily during the Holy Mass? Can a lay person preach? Can a Protestant ministry preach the homily during the Sunday of Christian Unity? The answer is, according to the teachings of the Catholic Church, only a priest or a deacon, and this, of course, extends to bishops, may preach the homily during the Holy Mass. Lay persons, Catholics or not, are never permitted to preach the homily during the Holy Mass. The Code of Canon Law says, Canon 766, lay persons can be permitted to preach in a church or oratory if necessity requires it in certain circumstances, or it seems advantageous in particular cases, according to the prescripts of the Conference of Bishops, and without prejudice to Canon 767, subsection 1. Canon 767, subsection 1 says, among the forms of preaching, the homily, which is part of the liturgy itself and is reserved to a priest or a deacon, and obviously the bishop, is preeminent. In the homily, the mysteries of the faith and the norms of Christian life are to be explained from the sacred text during the course of the liturgical year. A homily must be given at all masses on Sundays and holy days of obligation, which are celebrated with the congregation, and it cannot be omitted except for a grave cause. It is strongly recommended, furthermore, that if there is a sufficient congregation, a homily is to be given even at masses celebrated during the week, especially during the time of Advent and Lent, or on the occasion of some feast day or a sorrowful event. It is for the pastor or rector of a church to take care that these prescripts are observed conscientiously. Then it reverts to the germ, the general instruction of the Roman Missal. And it says, the homily should ordinarily be given by the priest celebrant himself. He may entrust it to a concelebrating priest, or occasionally, according to circumstances, to the deacon, but never to a layperson. In particular cases, and for a just cause, the homily may even be given by a bishop or a priest who is present at the celebration but cannot concelebrate. At the request of Pope John Paul II, the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments in Rome issued the document Redemptionis Sacramentum, for the purpose of stopping liturgical abuses. Regarding the preaching of the homily, the document reiterates the general instruction of the Roman Missal, section 66, and adds the following. It should be borne in mind that any previous norm that may have admitted non-ordained faithful to give the homily during the Eucharistic celebration is to be considered abrogated by the norm of the canon law. This practice is reprobated so that it cannot be permitted to attain the force of custom. If the need arises for the gathered faithful to be given instruction or testimony by a layperson in a church concerning the Christian life, it is altogether preferable that this be done outside of Mass. Nevertheless, for serious reasons, it is permissible that this type of instruction or testimony be given after the priest has proclaimed the prayer after communion. This should not become a regular practice, however. Furthermore, these instructions and testimonies should not be of such a nature that they could be confused with the homily, nor is it permissible to dispense with the homily on their account. In other words, like that priest was saying to me, I'm not going to give a homily. I want you to give the homily. And I said, I can't do that. No, I can't do that. So in any case, it goes on just a little bit longer, but you get the point. So I was pleased and thankful to the bishop, or to the deacon, rather, Deacon Richard, for confirming my sense that this is forbidden. Thank you. Let's go to Mark in Jersey Shore, Pennsylvania. I always get thrown when I see that name of that town. Jersey Shore, Pennsylvania doesn't probably match up with the Jersey Shore in New Jersey, I would guess. Right, Mark?
Not one bit. It's right in the middle of a state where it has absolutely no business being named Jersey Shore. So very confusing.
Okay. Well, good. Welcome aboard.
So here's my question, Patrick. My question is ultimately about guardian angels. The situation I'm in right now, I've been married for 20 years. My wife has been very unhappy in the marriage, and she has filed for divorce. I have fought and fought for the marriage for these 20 years, tried to do everything that I could, but she wants out. And anyway, we were married by a Protestant minister. And I had, because my wife is Presbyterian, I had gone to the diocese to get a dispensation. And my understanding was that our dispensation had been granted and that all of this time our marriage was recognized by the church. Well, as I'm exploring all of the elements of divorce here, and I looked into, okay, well, what is involved when I, after the divorce and I apply for an annulment and all of that, and when I called the diocese, there was no record of our marriage at the diocese, and I had them double and triple check this. So apparently the dispensation, for whatever reason, and I think I know the reason, did not go through. I think it had to do with a paperwork issue on the priest that was applying. So anyway, I won't go down that road. But there, essentially what I'm getting at is my understanding now, and this actually explains a lot, is my marriage was not recognized by the Catholic Church, so it would not have been covered in grace, and, you know, the grace of marriage that would have been given to a marriage that is, you know, is acknowledged by the Church. And so here's my question about guardian angels. All through this process, I've been praying for my children. We have four children. I pray to each of their guardian angels. And I also pray to the guardian angel of the family, because my understanding of guardian angels is that when you marry, the marriage itself is actually given a guardian angel. So since my marriage was not covered in grace, and maybe I'm misunderstanding that as well, but my belief now is that it was not covered in marital grace from the church, does it have a guardian angel at all? I mean, have I been praying to protection and oversight from this guardian angel when there wasn't an angel there? That is my question.
Okay. That's a, what a heartbreaking scenario that you're describing to me. Well, you certainly have a guardian angel. Your wife certainly has a guardian angel. Now, the question of your marriage having a guardian angel, that would be a matter of pious opinion. St. Thomas does say in his treatise on the angels that we each receive a guardian angel, but that those who have higher rank or they have more weighty responsibilities, that God will grant those people more than one angel to assist with them. But there's no teaching on the part of the church, and I'm not aware of St. Thomas saying this, that a marriage, in terms of the sacrament, is given a guardian angel. That would be something that could be true. It's possible, but I don't. There's nothing in the church's teaching that says that that's the case. So that's the first thing. Now, your prayers all along in good faith were not wasted. And to the extent that you were asking, you're calling upon the help of the holy angels for your marriage, certainly for your children, that did not go wasted. And God would apply those prayers, and whoever the holy angels were, who by God's permission would be involved in interceding for you and helping to guide you, that certainly happened, even if there was no particular angel designated to be a guardian angel of your marriage, you see. So I don't want you to feel as though all of those prayers were just wasted. They weren't wasted. In God's providence, they were applied as necessary, and whichever angels were involved, you'll meet them eventually in heaven. But if that, I hope that allays your concern that it was just wasted time, if that's what you're asking me.
Yeah, and I didn't have a concern for wasted time. I mean, this year has been an incredible year for spiritual growth. It took me to levels of prayer that I had never reached before. I mean, before I was praying maybe an hour a day. Now I'm praying a solid 3 to 4 hours a day vigorously and experiencing prayer in a whole new way. So in that way, it's been an incredible year for growth. But yeah, I was basing the understanding of a guardian angel for the family or something that, because I've listened to a lot of Father Ripperger's talks on marriage, and he talks there about, you know, that angels are given to a nation, they're given to a marriage, you know, that when you form that new union that you're assigned an angel. So I'm not sure where that comes from. I know I heard him say it. Maybe I'm misunderstanding. I have to go back and listen again, but that does help. And, you know, to understand, learning that my marriage was not covered in grace from the church was an eye opener. And I realized that on some level I was fighting a battle for my marriage that I thought I had an army behind me, and, you know, I had to look behind and said, wait a minute.
You do. And you do, even though if the marriage was not valid, or if there was some other problem with the marriage, you still have your guardian angel. You still have the holy angels who will pray for you. Of course, God himself, who desires your happiness and salvation. Let me ask you this. Is the situation so far gone that maybe there's not any hope, or would she maybe go on a retrovi weekend with you? Would that be a possibility?
I do not believe so. And without getting into too many of the details, I think what I'm dealing with here are mental health issues. And that's what I've really come to understand. And just, it's that there's, you know, I don't want to get into the details.
If there
were a chance for the marriage, I'll put it that way. If there were a chance for the marriage, I absolutely would, but not under the circumstances that she's created involving the children. I have to do something, and this was what the priest said to me. He said, Mark, this is too far gone. You know, you've got to do something for the benefit of the children at this point. If there were a chance, absolutely would I reconcile? Absolutely. I love my wife. I always will love my wife. I may not be able to love her as my wife. But thank you for the encouragement there. And we'll just see that we're not finished yet, and we'll see how things play out.
Fair enough. And I wish you well on that. I'll pray for you, Mark. Before you go, let me recommend a resource that I think you'll find helpful. It's the Opus Sanctorum Angelorum, which is Latin for the work of the holy angels. And the website, if you have a pen handy, is Opus, O-P-U-S, Angelorum, A-N-G-E-L-O-R-U-M. .org. Hang on, I just have a sneeze coming in. It doesn't want to come all the way out. Excuse me for that. But they have on this website, this is a religious order of priests who propagate and promote devotion to the holy angels. And they have lots of resources. So when you go to the website, opusangelorum.org, on the left side where it says holy angels, you'll see a catechesis on the angels, a frequently asked question about the angels, angel stories, angels in the writings of the saints, praying with the angels, and then prayers that you can use. And this is just one small part of the resources that are available here. So to further your study of this very important topic, I think you'll find that to be helpful. And you can also enroll if you want to enroll in the kind of the sodality of the holy angels. There is a way to enroll, and then you can be part of the ongoing prayers of these priests in their masses and the intentions of all the members around the world, and bring that to bear maybe for healing in your marriage. It's, as Jesus said, with man this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. I hope that helps, Mark. Thank you. We will take a quick break and come right back with more of your phone calls as we ride this wave to the end of the hour. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. We'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we'll go to Colleen in Minnesota. Hi, Colleen. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
My question is, our kids went from a Catholic school to the public high school, which up until this point, and it's been about 5-6 years, has been fine. Mm-hmm. But in this last year, all of a sudden, the gender ideology is getting pushed, and I'm kind of floored. The first one was we had, you know, the beginning of the school year, fill out a form, and it was not an option not to answer it. Mm-hmm. As far as what gender you identified with. So I just simply emailed the teacher and said, you know what? I would be happy to have my daughter fill out this form as soon as you remove the requirement to answer this question. Mm-hmm. And when you do, we'll be more than happy to. I'm just not interested in participating. Which she did. She couldn't remove it, but she added a line that said, prefer not to respond, which I thought was, okay, at least we got that far, right? Now, my daughter came home from Spanish class, and I took Spanish, right? And there's L and Ea. I'm sure my pronunciation isn't great, but now the Spanish teacher is like, well, I think we have a new word coming up that's going to be non-binary binding. And I'm like, what? What? Yeah. Since when? I'm like, that's not even part of the Spanish language. And I go, I'm pretty sure in Mexico, they're not doing that. I'm pretty sure you can go all through South America and it's not happening. And one of her classmates who went to Catholic school with her just walked up to the teacher and said, yeah, that's against my religion. I will not be participating. And I'm not sure if I just go that route or if I'm called to send a note that says, you know what, this isn't the Spanish language and you're promoting something that, I mean, to me, it's unhealthy. And I was talking to my other daughter and she was like, well, everybody does have a pronoun. I go, no, you don't. A pronoun is not, it doesn't identify, it's an identifier. It's not something you own. It's not a descriptor. It doesn't define you. I said, it's not a definer. It's an identifier to make it easy for the person who's listening to know who the person is speaking about, right? Mm-hmm. I said, if you ever try to listen to a story and they use they for a person, I'm like, what? How can you say that?
That's a plural. I correct that all the time.
So and I'm not sure how to respond. And I'm trying not to be angry, but I have to say, and I've had another teacher overstep bounds. I'm like, you're not the parent. Just teach your subject. I mean,
but see, they're radicalized, and even the teachers, and I know a few, who are not given to this ideology, they buckle down because they'll get fired. And so this is it's a tsunami that will crush everything in its path, and they're aware of that. So you either get on board or you better get out of the way. And I think that's what a lot of these teachers are living with. And for many of them, it's just easier to go along with it. So they do. Some are very zealous in favor of it, but others, they just go along.
And
go along.
I feel like this one's zealous, like she's looking for, just some of the comments she made mm-hmm. in class make me go, what, I'm trying to understand why.
Okay, I can help you. You need to read either or both of the following two books I'm going to recommend to you. If you have a pen handy, jot the titles down. One is called Irreversible Damage. That's by Abigail Schreier, S-C-H-R-I-E-R. Or there's no C in there, S-H-R-I-E-R, Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze That's Destroying Our Daughters, I believe is the subtitle. I've purchased that book, read it, and have given away many copies to other people. The second book is by Dr. Ryan Anderson. It's called When Harry Became Sally. And each of these authors, he is a Catholic, she's Jewish,
And both of them come at this topic of gender ideology from somewhat different vantage points, but they're both very helpful in triangulating and helping you understand what is going on here and why is this happening and what is the end game. And you're actually kind of experiencing the end game. The end game is conformity. They want to force everybody into this new ideology, whether you agree with it or not. And they're using fear and intimidation and bullying tactics to get their way. So from a clinical standpoint, if you want to understand this, those books will help you. Now, what do you do? Okay. I would advise you take your daughter out of that school. And you may say, well, I can't. Well, I mean, if there's a will, there's a way, as I look at it. Now, it's not for me to know what your personal family circumstances are. It's none of my business. But if I were in your position, I would move heaven and earth to either homeschool her or to get her into an acceptable Catholic school, if that's a possibility. If that's not a possibility, in any case, I would remove her from that situation and maybe get her into a charter school online program. There are many good Catholic homeschooling programs available. Seton comes to mind as an example. There are others. But there are options. It might require sacrifices on your part and your husband's part. But in the final analysis, when you have to give an account of your marriage and your life and your motherhood to God at the end of your life, you will be able to look God in the face and say, Lord, I did the very best I could with this child, and I made sacrifices that were necessary to remove her from a situation that could easily destroy her over time.
Think it's worth going to this school and going, hey, listen. I mean, up until this point, I would say the community as a whole has not really buckled to some of what's going on right now. So I'm a little... Mm-hmm.
You can try.
I'm honestly floored. I don't want to...
Minnesota, the state in which you live, is among the most far-left states in terms of the educational system. I mean, it's right up there with California and New York and other states like that. So you happen to be in a state where this has metastasized across all of academia. You can try, but I don't think the likelihood of you winning is very high at all, honestly.
Yeah, I once you get out of the Twin Cities, I'm in probably one of the most conservative areas. As soon as you get out of the cities, it gets a lot
better.
Farther right.
Okay.
My gosh, yes. I mean, we still have Christmas stuff, you know, so it's not so far gone that it's been demolished. But and that's why I kind of feel like if more of us started taking a stance of absolutely not. We're not going to buckle to this. We might be able to push back.
I'm in favor of pushing back. I truly am, and I don't want to dampen your ardor for defending your daughter and standing up to this nonsense. So I concur with you that there's a time and place necessary to do that. I was just speaking about the odds of you winning. Now, if you live in a particularly conservative area where most of the people are normal and most of the people see this nonsense for what it is, then yeah, give it a go. Push as hard as you can and see what happens. I hope I didn't give you the impression of defeatism or, you know, don't even bother. But on the other hand, how likely is it that you'll prevail? I guess you won't know until you find out.
And that's what I guess I'm starting to go. I feel like I just watched a program yesterday and was just talking about the fact that it's kind of a sickness. And everybody's just watching all this stuff and getting inundated. And one of the ways of fighting it back is to push back, to give truth and say, no. And what are you trying to accomplish here? Who are you servicing? You know, if there's a child that needs special attention, give that child special attention. But don't change everything we've done and try to change a language to accommodate a problem that's not there.
That's right. That's right. It's a solution in search of a problem, as the saying goes. Let me share with you, I've got to press on, but let me share a passage with you. This is from 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. It says, and then the lawless one will be revealed, and the Lord Jesus will slay him with the breath of his mouth and destroy him by his appearing and his coming. The coming of the lawless one by the activity of Satan will be with all power and with pretended signs and wonders, and with all wicked deception for those who are to perish because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. Therefore, God sends upon them a strong delusion to make them believe what is false, so that all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. So every time I think about this passage in 2 Thessalonians 2, I think about the current circumstances, and I really do see these people are deluded. They are brainwashed, and they're believing something that is false, and they will not detach from it, many of them. So how that plays out for any individual person, it's up to God. But in the meantime, as you yourself say, you need to push back against it. So I encourage that. I'm just thinking, in the long run, if you find that you're not getting anywhere, then my advice would be to give serious consideration to taking your daughter out of the school and homeschooling her if that's what's necessary. Thanks, Colleen. And you have my promise of prayers. I know what you're up against, and I really do hope and pray that things get better for you. Let's go to Vian now in San Diego. Hello, Vian.
Hi, Patrick. I called you a few weeks ago. It was a really rough time for me and struggling with my fiance about, it was mainly the vaccine and how he really wanted me to get it or else we would break up.
I started
thinking about just our future together and decisions that we'd have to make together, and I wouldn't want to be like I didn't have a say in anything, and that's where I saw it going, and I prayed and prayed a lot, and it was a struggle, but we actually ended it, and it hurts, but at the same time, I know it was, you know, I think the best thing, because I honestly feel so much at peace, even though it hurts, because we invested so much emotionally.
I can imagine.
But it also hurts a lot knowing that it was so easy for him to just drop everything and end it over the phone, you know, because we live in different cities. And
that's the key. That's that right there. You just identified it. You saw how easily he's like, oh, okay, see you later. I mean, he showed you something that it's so good that you saw it before you got married rather than after you got married.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you're going through the pain, but better to go through this kind of pain than a worse kind of pain after you got married and things would fall apart. I mean, if he really loved you, if you were really the center of his universe, if you were the woman he wanted to spend the rest of his life with, he would have fought for this. He would have figured out a way to make it work with you. And as you say, because he could so easily unplug from it, you now see who he really was.
Yeah. Yeah. I thank you for, you know, your help and your prayers. And it's definitely, you know, I encourage everybody to pray really hard when they're in that relationship. And I know it's difficult, but it's also a weird transition to just go from one point of life or a position in life to the next in a matter of, you know, hours. But
your whole life got turned upside down all of a sudden. Well, here, have you ever considered going on some of these Catholic dating websites? I know a number of them. And I got to tell you, I have met now probably, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say maybe a dozen couples who met on, you know, Catholic Singles or some of the other Catholic dating sites and have wonderful, very fulfilling, happy marriages. And they met each other that way. It's remarkable. Have you ever given any thought to that?
That's how I met him. I met him on Catholic Match. But I think for me, it was more easy that way because I'm more of a reserved person and, you know, just knowing that intention was there of meeting someone online. But of course, you know, I'm going to take some time to heal and to grow in my spirit and my relationship with God. And I'm hoping that, you know, eventually if that is my calling, I even started thinking about, oh, is this truly where God wants me, like in this vocation? I don't know, maybe it was just a terrible experience that I'm going through that I'm thinking that, but I'm open to wherever God takes me in.
That's good. That's the right attitude
in our church.
Yeah. That's the right attitude right there. Well, I can only imagine the pain, Vian, but it'll pass, and the pain will lessen over time, and you'll get stronger. And if God intends for you to be married, whoever he is, he's out there, and he's looking for you too.
Thank you.
All right. Well, keep your chin up. Keep your chin up. It's going to be okay. Thanks for calling me back, and thanks for letting me know how it is. It's another incentive for us to be praying for you. Thank you. I hope we talk again. And until we're together again, same Pat time, same Pat channel, I will be praying for all of you. Please remember me in your prayers as well. God bless you.